in that part of the world, given the complaints that are raised by the heads of Egypt and the fact that they're not able to get the necessary support mechanism from the desk. We have set the department to brief us on the other matters that the committee has raised over a period of time, issues like the matter that related to the negotiations with Science and Technology of Africa Institute and its location. We requested the department to discuss with us as to how far are we on that particular aspect, so that when they do their budget presentation today, they will also speak to some of those issues that we've requested them to deal with. And DG, when we looked at the presentation, the slides presentation, we realized that some of the issues that I'm raising were indeed dealt with and raised in that slide presentation, and probably will then be able to engage with them. But still, we have an interest to look at the desk and its relationship with the missions in the Levant area, given the number of complaints that arise from that particular area. We are quite interested in looking at that particular aspect. DG, there's an issue that has been outstanding of the fixed asset that has been consistently raised by members as to updating of the fixed assets of the department and the decisions that need to be made in regards to the disposal of certain assets that you may want to dispose of, that the matter has always been an outstanding matter that is supposed to have been dealt with, or what is the update on that particular aspect. There are issues that related to the current outcome of the building of the head office. Those are the issues that the committee felt that we should be able to deal with them as we move on. Having said that, I would ask the DG that we must introduce the team and probably take us through the presentation. Thank you, DG.
Sir, thank you very much.
Since the slide presentation, looks like I have to keep my finger on this point. I will try to work from the slide presentation. And honourable members, just to say that I'll start here on my right with Kirk Krobler, who's the acting DDG for Western Europe and the Americas. On my left is Ambassador Nene, who's the DDG for multilateral. Next to Ambassador Nene is Ambassador Jerry Machila, who's the DDG for Asia and the Middle East. And next to him is Asogen Moodley, who's the DDG Corporate Services and the CFO of the department. And next to him is the DDG Human Resources, Ms. Nompozolo. And next to her is Mr. Ngosi, Mtolisi Ngosi, who's our DDG for Africa. And behind us, starting with Ronnie Mamoepa, the head of public diplomacy. Ms. Nomfanelo Kota, who's the director, media liaison. Mr. Goso, who's the chief director and head of internal audit. Ibrahim, who's the director in the minister's office. So that's really the delegation that we have. We would like to, normally in these meetings, we'd have brought also a few other people, but at the same time, especially the colleagues in finance and human resources, we have a meeting going on in Durban with all our corporate services managers from our missions in the continent, who currently are meeting for a training and also a budget review process, which I will refer to in the course of the presentation. And also let me express, Chair, that my understanding is that both the Minister and the Deputy Minister are currently in Cabinet, and the idea was that should that be completed on time, they may well walk in and join us in the meeting. Starting with the first slide then, on the first slide just puts out the basic strategic priorities for the year under review. I think apart from the first top five, which basically relate to the political program of the department, the last one, organizational strengthening, really relates to cover the areas around corporate services that we cover. Now, I will propose to start with the issues around human resources and finance, and that is largely also informed by the fact that I thought most of the questions that did come relate to those areas. And as Chair, you correctly pointed out that a lot of the questions that you raised that we got, we've tried to integrate them into the presentation, and then there will be one or two that we will just expand on. And I will do the presentation, and then, of course, my colleagues will come in to help respond to the questions that may arise. Now, under human resources, we've got a list of areas there that we'll just cover very briefly, and again, some of them have been areas of concern to the committee, and I will now move on to the next slide, which is written slide 4, which is the, just to say that during the year under review, we filled in 429 posts. This is an issue that we report on an annual basis, both to demonstrate the progress we're making on beefing up the capacity in the department. And on slide 5, we give you a sense that what the vacancy level is in the department, and basically the relationship between filled and unfilled posts, both in the missions and head office, and also indicate that of the positions that we spoke about, 429, 280 were new external appointments, new addition to the department, and 149 were internal promotions. Now, I would just like to draw your attention to something I'll come back to later. You will notice when you look at our annual report that our expenditure level was 98.8%. So, in fact, that would also inform the fact that although we say we've got vacancies of 422, those are vacancies in terms of the approved organizational structure of the department. In order to fill those positions, in fact, we would have to make sure that we get additional resources from the Treasury, which is something that we're working on. I'd also like to draw your attention to the line there with the cadets, about 59 cadets. Just to say, we reported last year that we started the cadet program. The first group has completed. We've got a second group that is completing now. And, of course, we have started the process of recruitment for the third group of cadets that will come in January. The next slide, honorable members, just give you a sense of the breakdown in line with the tables that are suggested to reflect on employment equity, this slide and the next one. I would just like to draw your attention to the fact that if you look at top management, at the time, at the end of the financial year, which this was the accurate reflection, you will recall that we had actually, on the gender side in the top management, we had lost two senior members. We had lost Ambassador January Bardell, who had gone to join MTN, as you know, and we had also lost Jesse Duarte to the head office of the ruling party. Now, so indeed, that was the situation at the end, but just to report that subsequent to that, as of now, both Ms. Nompozolo, that has just introduced as our DDG for Human Resources, and Ms. Motromo have been appointed to the DDG level. The next table is just a reflection of the same, but using a slightly different categorization. Now, there was the question, sir, that you had asked that wanted us to reflect on the people who are returning, diplomats are returning at the end of the financial year, or rather at the end of the year. Now, we thought we'd do this in two ways. Initially, we thought that we would cover the period under review, but I have additional information here that will give the sense of what is happening by the end of December this year. But essentially, if you look at this slide in relation to the next slide, in December 2007, we had 97 of these officers were supposed to return. 61 of them actually returned, and 36 had their terms extended. What we tend to do at the end of the year, or rather during every returning cycle, and we have two returning cycles, end of June and end of December, because of the pressures that sometimes we have to get suitable people, I've reported to the committee before that we have a tension of trying to maintain proper functioning of the mission, but at the same time, we are very anxious that headquarters should be strong, and secondly, as we are recruiting new people into the department, we must have the capacity to integrate. So we need some experienced people to be in headquarters to help integrate these new people that we are recruiting. So sometimes, and sometimes, of course, the posting in missions in the case of our department is on a voluntary basis. So we might find that sometimes at a particular point in time, we're not getting the profiles of people that we want, especially when we consider your regard to the issues about making sure that the representation in our missions broadly is reflects the sort of balance that we would like to see. So we tend to then engage the heads of missions, look at whether there are officers that are supposed to return, where the heads of missions would be keen to have them extended. We then speak to those officers whether themselves they are keen to be extended. And at the end of the process, we then look at the net deficit in terms of the position that will fit. And that's why you'll see there reflected that the people who are supposed to return was 97, but the people who actually returned is 61, and the number who were extended is 36. But in that particular case, we then still had a problem of about 21 positions that we could not sort out and 40 people that we did. If we were to look at the current year, for example, the people who are expecting to return to head office by the end of December 2008 across all categories, from the ambassadors to any transferred official in the mission, is about 95 people that whose terms are actually ending. The reason we can't give you exactly the full picture of what will happen for 2008 December is that the processes along the lines that we did in 2007 are still unfolding. The next slide just indeed explains that process, that we tend to ask for extension, then we advertise internally in the department to indicate what vacancies are available in the mission, and sometimes we identify individuals to do intermission transfers. And I must say, increasingly, we're trying to reduce the number of people who move just from one mission to the other. We do it still, but we try to reduce that so that people can go into the normal cycle of spending time outside, come back to head office so that they can actually reconnect with the country before they go out for another posting again. The next slide basically just relates to one of the areas of focus to us in the department. Increasingly, we are finding that sometimes we advertise and we struggle to get the position, to get a suitable candidate, which then leads us to really spending a bit of time. We've asked our HR to spend a bit of time to assist us to manage and try to nurture the people already in the department so that we can manage our attrition rate as much as possible. And a round part of that, which is basically twofold. One, we are trying to do to manage the people who are internal in the organization, but also to make the department more attractive by going far much more out to attract people into the department. And this basically is what is covered under the employer branding, where we use the number of publications, FABC, visit institutes of higher learning, visit schools. We are actually planning far much better when we move into the new premises, because when we designed the new premises where the department is going to go, we had in mind also that we must have possibilities for a a foyer area where we can run exhibitions at particular time and encourage schools to come in and see and get a feel of what basically the international relations work involves. So we hope that, again, will open up the possibilities for people. Now, one of the things that we've done under career management and retention of talent, we've started an initiative where we're basically creating a career center in the department. This is aimed at trying to make sure that every employee of the department is fully aware of the possibilities that exist within the department, the sort of career options that they can exercise within the department apart from what they are doing. And this is also going to be a web-based system that would then allow our officials who are outside also to interact, and as people think about their development, they can then pose specific questions and then be assisted to think through around the career options that they may wish to follow. The next slide, honorable members, just talked about the work that we did on the foreign service dispensation. We have spoken to you last time that the FSC was being reviewed. That process was completed. A new system has been introduced. The only thing that is outstanding that we are working with the government medical scheme on is basically really to alter the current system of medical cover for our officials abroad and try to link it directly with GEMS, the government medical scheme. But in principle, we've agreed, but we're just trying to work on the mechanics of that. That is taking longer than we might have thought. Now, the next slide is around performance management. Now, this is one, the next two slides to be seen together. Basically, what we've done is that as part of the improvement of the functioning of government, we previously reported that the Auditor General increasingly is moving towards performance auditing, and there's an expectation for department to improve their system. In our case, one of the initiatives we have focused on is that as we consolidate performance management for South Africa, either in the missions or in headquarters, to begin to introduce the system for our LRPs, and therefore there has been a review of that process, and it's part of what we are now rolling out. And the next page just gives you a sense of really the process, that's the slide that comes out of the annual report. It gives you a sense of our assessment of the profile of the performance of the department by categories, what percentage of people that we are putting into the commendable range, and what percentage of people we regard as outstanding, and those that are below satisfactory will then be the people that the institution is trying to pay particular attention to look at whether they can be assisted. And just to say, one of the things that we've done, we sometimes have created, people raise questions about it, but we believe it's the correct way to deal with it, is that after line managers have made their own assessment of their of the people working with them, we have department-wide moderating committees. And those department-wide moderating committees then help for us to make sure that the benchmarks that we're using are the same, so that if we are saying people are commendable, for example, are working in Asia, Middle East with Ambassador Matila, that there's some sort of relating that performance to people who might be working in Africa, so that we're using the same benchmarks and not have perhaps some supervisors might be more generous than others, just to balance that out. And with respect to members of the senior management, us sitting here as the DDGs, we all sit in committee to evaluate all the chief directors of the department. And Ms. Nompozolo chairs the committee of all the chief directors, where they sit, all of them in committee, to look and review the performance of all the directors, and the supervisors then can motivate. We are generally happy with the unfolding of the performance management system in the department. Of course, there are still some areas of concern. There are discussions that we have started with the DPSA, which is a government-wide process about how to tighten up the situations of people where sometimes they sign performance agreements, but in terms of the performance evaluation, those processes are not completed. Now, we also refer to, which is the next slide, just to say that there was a culture and climate survey that we did in the department that we've completed, and we are now rolling out the implementation of the findings of that.
Chairperson, sorry.
Are we expected to listen to this last slide? important to really remember the related matter, ask any questions, and then vote for another one. Otherwise, I don't think it's a good discussion. It's a discussion of the future.
Thank you very much. Of course, I think we are continuing to register some progress on the issue. Of course, it's still a challenge around the issue of making sure that the targets on employment equity are all met. Now, on the slide 15 on the employee wellness, again, we've spoken to the committee, I think, when we presented our budget this year. We indicated that one of the things that increasingly is becoming clear to us is that we might be underestimating the impact of the transitions for some of our employees when they go, especially when they go to foreign lands for the first time, or also the process of adaptation and adjustment of their relatives, of their children. And so more focus on the employee health and wellness issues has become a major issue for us. And I think the most important thing here now is really that the employment is the commencement of the electronic healthcare system for all the health workers. And essentially what we are trying to do is to work towards the creation of a system hotline that would be available 24 hours, that would allow any of our employees, wherever they may be, in the event of some sort of distress, to be able to link up and get the appropriate professional help. The other issues, I think, are relatively straightforward. Now, Chair, you raised in your question a number of issues that are labor relations related, and therefore I'll just spend a bit of time on that. Now, in slide 16, we have a clear labor relations framework which is obviously consistent with the legislation that we have. Just to say that one of the things that we've battled with over the years was to try and improve the speed with which we finalize labor relations cases, and I think a lot of progress has been made in that respect. Now, during the period under review, which is we had about 34 disciplinary cases, of which 22 were finalized in the course of 2007-2008. Now, of the 12 that remained as of 31st of March this year, just to indicate, 9 of those have already been finalized now. So, in essence, of the cases, 34 cases that we had last year, only 3 continue to drag on that we're still trying to work on. Now, and currently there are 12 cases before the department. Now, those 12 cases are a combination of the 3 that were carried from the previous financial year and 9 new ones. Then we had 16 out of 21 grievances that were resolved, and just to say the disputes that have been finalized were in favor of the department. There was a specific question, Chair, that is raised with respect to the case of the former head of mission in Ramallah in Palestine, who returned to head office in 2006. There was a specific question that we should talk about it. Just to say to honorable members, you will recall that in this particular case, there was a suggestion of improper conduct on the side of this particular head of mission. The head of mission was called to head office. There were allegations made around issues of sexual molestation that were in the newspapers, but we could not establish that those statements were true. And in any event, what further complicated the issue is that the person concerned was to liaise with the authorities both in Israel and also in Palestine. The person concerned, first of all, changed the statement and thereafter withdrew the charges against the official. And so the approach of the department was then to say, yes, to the extent that there might have been improper relationships, that would not have been proper conduct for a person in his position, but it was not of the severity that was initially reported. And we could not, as I say, the official denied, we could not establish an objective basis. The person who made the allegations changed the story halfway and thereafter withdrew the case. And so at the end of the day, and there was no indication that there was any pressure put by the official, because at the time all that was happening in Jerusalem, the official was already back here in head office. So we were also satisfied that we did not get a sense that there was a pressure put by the official. So the official was brought back, stayed for a while in the department, but because of what had happened, we thought that during the next opportunity that the person got to go out, that they would not go as part of the function, would not go as head of a mission, but more in a supportive role. And that is what has happened. Now, on page 17, with respect to the labor relations, you wanted the cases that are before the department, and we've listed all of them. And you will see that most of them really around the dereliction of duty, 7 and 8. One official who's alleged to have had the social grant was in the employ of government, issues of intimidation to fellow colleagues. Then, of course, the cases that you had referred to, which are related to case number 11 and 12, which is the allegations about abusive, vulgar, and racist remarks against LRPs by the staff in this particular case in Palestine. Once that was brought to our attention, of course, this was immediately investigated. The relevant employee was recalled. And just prior to the commencement of formal disciplinary processes, the employee is not well. So that process is held in abeyance until the person is able to be able to face the disciplinary processes. But the person has been recalled back to head office. In the event, in the case of number 12, I am told by the investigating officers that pretty soon we will know the actual recommendations that they are making, and this is the case in Syria. Just to say then, those are the cases, those are the 12 cases that the department, and I think if you've got any interest in any one of them, then we can deal with that as a specific case, but these are the cases that the department is dealing with. The next question that we thought we should expand on is the information that we're seeking about legal cases that are before the court that the department is defending. The first one, Ganga versus the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and I'm on slide 20. This is actually the person who was heading the mission, our mission in Ramallah, before this. We've spoken about the one before, the current ambassador, but the one before that. And basically, again, there were problems there that involved the locally recruited staff, and there were concerns about the general performance of the mission. The head of mission was recalled, and after being recalled, I think he was advised by his lawyer not to turn up for work. And on the basis of that, after at the last of 30 days, we invoked the provision in the Public Service Act because he had basically not showed up for work for 30 days without giving a reason, and so he was dismissed from the service. And he then took us to court. He was taking us to court at the time, he was not coming to work. He was taking us to court to say if we are recalling him, all what he considered to be the benefits that would have accrued to him in terms of the allowances must be paid back to him. And then he was claiming other damages, hurt, and all sorts of things. But, of course, we did not believe that. First of all, we thought that the allowances paid are paid for people because they are there discharging a service, not when they are in Pretoria. and some of the allegations. So we are challenging that, and this case has been dragging on. So that is the first case. The next two cases really relate to the situation, which is an old situation around the integration of the people from the TBVC state in 1994-95, that period. And during that time, there was an issue of the adjustment of the positions of the people who were working, coming particularly from the TBVC state. And what then happened was that this process dragged on. It was difficult to finalize it. And sometime in 2004, we then took and agreed with the unions that on all the outstanding issues, let's go out for arbitration. And all of us will accept the recommendation of the arbitrator as binding. So we did that. It so happens that in this particular case, most of the members of the union then accepted the outcome of that, which ruled in some of the things in favor of the union, in some of the elements in favor of the department. And it so happens that in the case of these two officials, now that what was of interest to them ruled in favor of the department, they have wanted to reopen the situation. And of course, we're defending the department on that. The next case relates to, it's a case in the labor court around our former ambassador to Vietnam, and again we have invoked the provision of the Public Service Act because there was a disciplinary case, and again it's taken us to court, and that issue is ongoing. I think the one that is of importance, perhaps more so to the committee, would be the Von Arbor case. Here we are joined together with other state departments, and it really relates to a farmer who had land confiscated in Zimbabwe and has gone to the court and essentially is arguing that the South African government did not do enough to protect their interests. The court ruled against the state. We were given a number of days to provide more evidence of what measures we would be taking after that. There are a number of steps that we have taken. In fact, just last week we filed the affidavits to court on this issue. So that's the Van Arbor case. So we were also involved in it. And then we've got the cases of people who've been dismissed and are challenging that in the labor court, and the other case, which is a new case, which is in Chile about somebody who wants both to continue working after the age of 65 and also for us to pay him a pension in our mission in Chile. And we are trying to challenge that. So essentially, those would be the spectrum of the legal cases that the department is trying to defend. And just to conclude this section, Chair, just to say that our priorities looking forward, just bearing in mind all of that, we really believe that in the next year or two, the department still has to focus a lot on this issue of recruitment, selection, and placement, the issue of talent management, the issue of career development and succession management in the department. And of course, coming from the culture survey, there are certain pointers of what we need to strengthen that to improve the overall management and leadership of the department. And those are the areas we'll be focusing on. Chair, I will stop there then. In line.
Thank you, DJ. Members note, we've gone from first page to page 23. And from there we'll be dealing with page 24 to page 34, because all of them deal with the, before we start the African Renaissance Fund. Are there issues and comments on the human resource issues? 1, 2, 3. Let's start with the 3 hands.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thank you, DG, for your presentation. Just 2 questions for clarification. There was indication that members of staff's contract have been, they afforded the opportunity to stay in their post. My question is that diplomatic post or is it financial control post? If it's financial control post, what risk assessment are you taking to ensure that in those missions there are, steps to scrutinize the finances of the department. You've made mention here of the court cases that's outstanding. Now, in page 85 of the annual report, there is a list of cases. There's also a case of the City Steel Project product with the Republic of South Africa. There are abilities mentioned as 10 million, if I'm issue, if I'm correct. I just want to know whether those liabilities have been finalized or are they still under negotiation?
Now, firstly, with regard to the former head of mission in Palestine, because it was a public issue, appeared in the media and so on and so forth. And now I see that apparently no disciplinary action has had to be taken because there was no need. In other words, it seems as if the former head of mission has been cleared. I wanted to find out from the department whether now, what is it that we are going to do to ensure that he is also cleared publicly, because the matter was very public, and I think it also came up in Parliament time and again. But I don't remember ever reading or hearing that actually the case has been concluded in this manner. Now, secondly, with regard to the issue of the farmer versus the department, the farmer from Zimbabwe versus the department, that also has been a public issue. We have read about this in the media. But the moment I read about it, I just wondered, how far can a government, say like the South African government, how far can we go in defending people who have been affected by the laws of another country where they have been residing? In other words, I want to take it that the farmer has lost his farm because of the laws of Zimbabwe being implemented, and then South Africa is supposed to assist this person retain his farm. How far can you go in this area? How far can a country go in defending its citizens who have been affected by the laws of another country?
Thank you, Chairperson, colleagues, and the DGN staff. I think we must commend you, firstly, because the last time we were at your head office, we had too many vacancies, and it looks like you have addressed that section very well. How I wish that one of the departments which I serve in this portfolio committee could emulate what the Foreign Affairs is doing, the Department of Sport. It looks like they are going from bad to worse. There will be no orders, but the issue I wanted to raise was the question of this Gangat. If you admit that you have already, there's no case, why are you still in court instead of talking about settlement? Because you are now going to make the lawyers rich and richer and wait for this date to come. Maybe it will be after 2 years and you create uncertainty. And other people might view that as nothing else but a vendetta against this individual. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll just ask Asokem to look for the question about the liabilities on the steel, just to look at the facts. I was trying to look at that. But I would imagine we tried to all the cases. There are certain cases that we did not include here because we cleared them between March and now. We thought we'd update the committee on just what is remaining. But maybe let me start with the last with what Honorable Olumisa is saying. On the case of Ganga, you know, we've had a series of cases where the officials, I should just say, Chair, because this case is familiar to you, you wrote to us at some point, there was the Kwepile case, for example, where the principle involved is around the fact that when the department withdraws an official back from a mission, that the officials want to say, you are withdrawing me after 2 years. I was going there to be there for 4 years. There are certain allowances that I was going to get. and they start wanting to argue as if the allowances themselves are a right regardless of where you are. When the allowances are meant to deal with the assisting to adjust for your cost of living because you are in a foreign country. Now, so part of the issue around the Gangad case is the principle, and our view is that this is a principle that we have to defend, because if we become soft on it, then actually it opens a Pandora's box for us. So far, it's only that this one has gone to fully into court. The others have ended up to go to the CCMA, and then we've won them at the level of the CCMA. So that's why we think it's important for us to deal with the issue of Gangad. On the issue of the Van Albo case is not the first one, Honorable Manjobe, that we've dealt with. There were two previous cases where one of them even went to the Constitutional Court. And in fact, the ruling at that point in time was that we had demonstrated the measures that we had taken in line with, in a sense, consular services, exploit our bilateral representation, help South Africans to seek redress in a foreign country. And therefore, it was argued in that particular case that there's a point beyond which the South African government cannot go in terms of respecting the laws of that particular country. In this particular case, I think what happened was that the judge, for a variety of reasons, remember that with Zimbabwe, we needed to sign the bilateral protection of investment, which was delayed. Now, delayed not because of the South African side. In fact, Minister Mphahla has made a number of statements where he said he was ready to go and sign. There were dates, about three of them, then were changed by the Zimbabwean side. But the logic of the judge was that we had not done as much as we're supposed to do. Now, and that is the test that he used, and then gave the department a period of about 60 days to then demonstrate additional steps that have been taken, which we have then used both to, again, place on record, have new discussions with the government of Zimbabwe, but far much more important to place on record and make clearer some of the points that steps that have been taken before, because that is the test that they seem to be trying to use. But as I say, this one is more difficult because, as I say, we've just filed our responding affidavit on Monday at early this week. So it's an evolving thing. But our understanding has been South Africans, we have to help them. We have to help in the sense of making sure that we facilitate their interaction with the legal processes of that country. But we can't make a determination. There's a limit to which we can go. And I think the test is just a question of whether, in fact, we've done as much as we're supposed to do. We believe that we've done everything in this particular case. More worrying to us is that after the ruling of the Van Ober case, three other farmers have written to the department, and it's quite clear that they want to follow exactly the same argument. So I think we will see how we deal with that. On the disciplinary case with respect to, maybe let me just make a slight correction. Without getting into all the details around the case, there was something that the ambassador had done which we thought was improper in terms of the relationship with the person who was working. But it was quite clear, or his argument was that this was all consensual, as opposed to the issue of the way it was projected in the media. Now, so we concluded that indeed this was not advisable for the ambassador to have had that sort of relationship. So there was a sanction, and that sanction, that's why I'm saying we recalled him back to Pretoria. Secondly, we made it very clear that his next assignment, he would not go as the head of mission. And that was the sanction that we did. Now, at that time, and we will just have to look and help clarify the issue, because I think it's an important one, but I think at that point, because the media was chasing us, there is a point at which I think the issue of the withdrawal of the case by the person who had laid the case, as well as the change of the statement, was made public in the media. And I think we had released the statement. So that would be the point, and Mr. Mamwepa can further expand on that. On the issue of whether there are any the people that are extending in the missions, just to say some of the people who are extending indeed are people in charge of corporate services, which therefore means they are managing our finances in the mission. First of all, let me just say that when we extend, we now have a policy that we extend people for 1 year, and we've become very reluctant to do that more than that. But secondly, remember that all our missions go through a particular cycle, both our own internal audit, then there's also the unplanned external audit from the, and of course at the slightest indication, we again can put an ad hoc internal audit, send our internal audit function. So we do not think it exposes us to risk. We think that the safeguards that we have in the department generally would be adequate. But also remember that on a monthly basis, there's an interaction between us and the mission in the process of the closure of our financial statements. So we follow them on a month-by-month basis as we aggregate our reports that we'll have to take to the... And finally, just to say that with our system of delegation, I think there are pretty tight safeguards in terms of our system that limit, and that is why I think in the disciplinary cases that we have, we don't see much of either, certainly corporate services managers, involve themselves in major misconduct related to financial irregularities, and I think part of it is because of a bit of tightness of our regulatory framework and the systems that we've put in place to check that. Much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Can we
another measure that we apply when we extend corporate services managers in particular is that we consult with finance specifically mission accounts, so that they can then recommend the people that have done their work properly. We also consult with Mr. Koso, who's the Chief of Internal Audit, to also make sure that we don't extend anybody where there are investigations or there's improper behavior. Thanks.
I just want to say that welcome to the Minister. We saw you coming in. We're for one that as soon as your cabinet meeting is over, you'll be able to join us. You're welcome. Let's first start with Honorable Holomisa with a follow-up question and then come back to you.
So, Chairperson, is this gentleman still working for the department, Mr. Kangati, and if he's still there or even if he's not there, did you conduct any inquiry, internal inquiry, with a view to discipline both the whistleblower and who turned up, withdrew it again, because they have indeed put the name of the foreign affairs into disrepute?
Can I just clarify first the that's why I was struggling to find these two heads of missions of Ramana. Ramana seems to be... The case of Gangat is a separate one, and Gangat was dismissed from the service. So he's basically challenging us from outside the department. That's Gangat. In the case of the other head of the mission, the one who followed Gangat, the problem that we had is that the relationship was not even with a Palestinian or an Israeli, it was with a foreign national who was working in our mission, which was the Philippines. So we had also limitations, the extent to which we could engage that process. So in effect, what we then did is, because what really happened was that the first statement that our head of mission gave us was more or less in line with the second statement that this particular employee gave. when SC was reporting the case, essentially because it was quite clear, at least what appeared to be on the surface, is that this is a worker who was working in our mission and needed to have a renewal of their work permit in Israel, because we're staying on the Israeli part of Jerusalem, which was working for our ambassador, was the ambassador to Ramallah. And in the process of that, had certain expectations about what the interaction might assist in terms of this possibility to extend this. But for some reason, that was not done, and hence the accusation. At least that's how it came out towards the end. And so the measure was taken because it was felt that the relationship was improper, but it was not of the gravity as we initially feared. And with respect to trying to correct the situation, that's why I was trying to say that's the way we dealt with it. I'm trying to be careful to participate.
Honorable Kosana, and Honorable Chudi, and Honorable Peko.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know how to pose this, because it's not a question, really. I was simply looking at the relationship between the portfolio committee and the ministry and the Department of Foreign Affairs. And I know from the face value that our constitutional mandate is the oversight. But as I was also listening to the DG, the first part of it on resources, on human resources. Something also came into my mind. I just thought when it comes to the orientation of the national agenda and also the foreign policy of our country, including the questions of moral and ethical philosophy, which we were talking about now with these people who are in the cases and so on. And then I was looking at the new recruits. I was looking at the fresh diplomats, the retainees, and so on. Then I simply wanted to know what role could the portfolio committee also play, apart from simply being oversight, which is really an overblown type of word itself. What is that that we can do to assist the department and the ministry as a portfolio committee? I reflected on some of the roles of the Judicial Service Commission, with people who are coming into offices, judges and so on, and I was looking at people who are coming into office as diplomats, whether they are career diplomats or political diplomats. Don't we need an interaction with them as a portfolio committee to look at the question of the national agenda, whether they really do understand themselves from that point of view? Look at these questions of the moral and ethical orientation. And what do you do when you're out there? I was looking at that, Mr. Chairman. I don't think there could be an answer for that now, but at some point the department might want to say, apart from oversight, the portfolio committee ought to be looking at this question: how do we assist the department and the ministry in terms of aligning and realigning these views? Thank you.
You know, it's just not clear in my mind whether there is a policy, how the department handles the whole issue of these people that we've been talking about, you know, legal matters that are questionable. Like, do they come back to the department and be kept and continue to work until the case has been investigated and resolved, and or
are they suspended, on pay, or something like that, until, again, the same thing? Or there will be some instances where they are, you know, perhaps just, you know, dismissed, you know, straight away. How do you really sort of, you know, decide when and what to do? Because there's also the theme of the cases, you know, taking a long time, you know, to reach, you know, conclusion. Now, are they working and being paid, or are they in suspension and that sort of thing? What is the actual policy? How are your judgments in that case dependent on some kind of policy that one can understand? Thank you.
My seat hasn't got this type of facility, Chair, so that's why I moved here. My question is a very simple one indeed. I would think that foreign affairs or foreign missions are very important in a nation, and I'm a little bit wondering about the number of labor disputes. It looks like there are quite a number. Maybe that I'm talking from ignorance of not understanding the situation, and I'm wondering what is the cause of so many labor disputes in this department? Are we recruiting the right quality of people who understand, for instance, the kind of missions they are involved in? Well, I'm from the United Nations, and I think I behave very well there as a diplomat.
Thanks a lot. Chairperson, I would also want to make a very right on this one, but I'll start by commenting about the issue of Amakangangat that I nearly covered. Again, my question nearly the same. Maybe if the department maybe can clarify us the type of criteria they use for some of these ambassadors. Why I'm raising it? You see, it's sometimes very disturbing, in particular in international, like exactly in the Middle East. I'll quote one case whereby in Israel, there were a lot of damaging statements from one of the ambassadors about the very same country, which is South Africa. And then also, I'm a little concerned in that regard about the supporting desk which is provided to the mission, because the report we got there is that the support desk is very weak. Maybe that's why it's creating a lot of problems. Maybe we can clarify us on that one. And lastly, the visibility, I will put an example, the issue of if you go to Gaza, and same in Ramallah, it's Ramallah and Gaza, just across. Some of the people, they indicated that South African embassy is not visible enough in Gaza. Thank you, Jennifer.
Did you? Probably in your comment, you'll probably share with us whether, in your view, will you think that at any given point in time, with all other considerations made and everything being equal, is it appropriate for a head of mission, on the basis of mutual consent, on the basis that there's a reasonable expectation of the benefit, that the head of mission should find himself
engage in an activity that creates that particular situation. Over and above the moral aspect is the security aspect that goes with it. I want to assume that all our diplomats at that level are vetted, and I want to assume that therefore when that happens, it affects the vetting of that individual. When individual is then sent out on the basis that may not be sent as a head of mission, surely that affects the level of that vetting of that individual, because the behavior has a direct bearing. Given the fact that the person involved was not even a local national, was a foreigner who was there, legal, illegal, it's a question that's open. So I'm saying that in your consideration, do you think that the steps we've taken are appropriate to safeguard our own security as a country on the behalf of such diplomats?
Thanks. I'll just deal with the one part of this question, and then I'll ask request Ambassador Matilda, who's going to try and help on the other side. As I said, Ambassador Matilda is the deputy for Asia and the Middle East. And that would deal probably with also the questions around the assessment of the desk and generally what is raised as problems related to that part of the world. But maybe on the more general issue, just to say, Honorable Member Lutuli, when if, for example, I mean, there's the steps that we are taking, if there is any transgression, the first step that we take is to obviously investigate that. And then we come to a determination whether we believe that on the basis of that investigation there are grounds for charging somebody with misconduct. If we are going to charge the person with misconduct after the investigation, and that investigation is done relatively very fast, immediately after something has come to our attention, we then have to appoint, in terms of the Labor Relations Act, a presiding officer. Now, in terms of the Labor Relations Act as it stands now, the view of the presiding officer is final. And the only recourse the person has is to appeal. And when they appeal to the executive authority of the department. Now, we've been fighting to try and do in the department is to shorten that process, to make sure that once a case is reported, we speed it as much as possible. Now, there is not so much as departmental policy, but there's a general understanding in the labor relations area that if we believe that there is a possibility for the individual either to interfere with that process while the investigation is taking place or during the process of the misconduct trial or misconduct hearing, then sometimes we suspend that person. And normally because, of course, we can't prejudice the person before a determination is made, and that suspension is on full pay. If I were to give you an example, I can just recall just one particular person here where the labor case in number four, I think it's the one, where we talk about insolence and disrespectful conduct towards the supervisor. This includes some threats. In this particular case, I recall specifically that we then felt that the person might intimidate witnesses and therefore was out of the environment. Now, the person, as you can see, is appealed because the presiding officer felt that what he had done in a work environment required actually a dismissal. So he's appealing against the dismissal. In this particular case, of course, the appeal is going to be heard either by the minister or by the deputy minister. So that is the I think I'm trying to respond to the question of whether we keep them within the organization or they are. Now, in some of the cases like Gangat and them, it's a more difficult thing because actually these are individuals who then either they were advised by their lawyers,
that because they did not accept the sanctions, and we've had three cases like that in the recent past, let's say in the past few years, where a person is not happy with the sanctions that we're putting on, and then their reaction is then not to show up for work when we actually have not suspended the person. And in that particular case, we are perfectly entitled in our view to invoke the particular provision of the Public Service Act, which then says the person has not showed up for work for 30 days without good reason, and the person then gets dismissed on that ground. So you'll find that some of the dismissals are linked to that, but some of the dismissals is, I think, really where we've had dismissals, I can't recall of a sanction of dismissal that has been appealed and then reversed by the appeal authority, because we also do take that decision very seriously. And we suspend on full pay only when we are convinced that the person actually can negatively interfere with the investigation. Apart from that, we allow the people to continue with the work whilst they are being investigated. So that is the part I thought I would. Chair, I really, it's a more difficult one, Chair, the question that you are raising. I must say, sitting where we are now, I think our sense is probably in the process of trying to avoid into getting too much detail on this on this particular case. I really think we try to apply our minds on the case of Ramallah, that case in Ramallah, and we really thought we really came at the end of the day. The two issues that are usually these decisions boil down to is this a dismissible offense, or it's not a dismissible offense? If it's a dismissible offense, then you dismiss. If it's not a dismissible offense, if you feel that you have not crossed that line where you actually have to dismiss somebody, then it basically means you are then accepting that the person, there are some remedial steps that have to be taken. And those remedial steps would include, for example, in this particular case, a recall for a diplomat is a very significant act. And in this particular case, to take somebody who was heading a mission and send them out again in a subordinated position, we felt that it is a significant act. But at the time, and I still think even now, that although we thought it was improper conduct, but we did not believe it was a dismissible offense. Now, the issues that you are talking about, Chair, about what the people are opening themselves, obviously, to security, I think they are well taken. Those are true, and that's part of the sort of logic that follows for us to say, but this action is actually improper. So that would be the first one. And maybe just to say the other point that we've learned a bit from some of this. Remember in the past, we reported this to the committee sometime back. In fact, I think, Chair, when you visited us in the department, that's when we discussed this. In the past, we were not there to help business. But we have now started the process of vetting heads of mission. So you actually ended up with two heads of mission. Some would be vetted on account of being career diplomats because officials in the department are vetted. But the people who are coming from outside were actually not vetted. But that process has subsequently changed. Ambassador Man.
Just before that. Federal Health Department. You see, there is a thin line here between a politician and an ambassador. So, you sometimes you don't have to prove beyond reasonable doubt. The balance of probabilities normally guide a DG as to whether this individual has put the name of the country into disrepute and so on. But in terms of when you recall that individual, but if you stick now to labor-related issues and make sure that the law, you follow the guidelines. But in the case of Mr. Gangat, I'm not clear exactly why did you dismiss him. Can you be specific on it?
In the case of Mr. Gangat, there was a problem in Ramallah. We brought him back. When we further assessed the situation, we felt that the divisions that they created and the number of other things in Ramana were such that we would not return him back to Ganga, to Ramana. He did not like the decision. He then, for reasons that are unknown to us, decided to abscond whilst he was taking us to court. And at that point in time, because he then spent about 30 days, in fact it was more, without coming to work, with no permission not to come to work, because we had a dispute, and the dispute did not mean that he should not come to work. And on the basis of that, in terms of the Public Service Act, was then dismissed. So that's basically what happened in this case, leading to the dismissal. Ambassador,
Mr.
Honourable Member, in terms of relationship between the head of Mission Israel and the desk at head office. Honourable Member, you will remember that once the president appoints the head of mission, what we do at Foreign Affairs is to assist with the training, to give them the tools to do the work. Secondly, we expose them to the desk, how the desk functions, and therefore the reporting lines. The second issue that we'll be dealing with is a very delicate one. We are in a transition. The government, we are all in transition with Foreign Affairs. So we have colleagues who served in the old department, who served in the TBV states, who served in the ANC. So we integrate people, and sometimes it's not very easy during this processes. So sometimes it's not a question of systems, really. The issue of attitudes, the issue of personalities, which you can address at a particular point. But this relationship between the head of mission and the desk has not created a crisis in terms of management our strategic objectives in the Middle East or in Israel back. There's been a mini tension from time to time between the head of the business unit and the head of mission, which some of us have been way in between and trying to resolve. So I think it's a manageable thing, and we hope that we can improve that situation as time goes on. In terms of the negative statements, I have not received a record of the negative statements by the head of mission from Israel that we can say as a result of that, it has put in question his continued activity in Israel, or it has put into question the relationship between South Africa and Israel. In terms of the visibility of our mission in Gaza and Ramallah, I remember to recall that Foreign Affairs took a deliberate decision to open up a post in Gaza to try to keep contact with both sides of the Palestinian political systems. Honourable Member, you recalled too that those of you who have gone to Gaza, I have not been there, but I'm told by the chair when you went to Gaza that you have to go through so many roadblocks, and it's a very, very difficult process. So what we do is to encourage the head of mission to go there regularly. We have a post in Gaza to go there regularly to make sure that they keep contact with the Hamas in particular. That post was created to make sure that we keep contact with Hamas. It was even more important when in June, in the NAS process, Minister Skweyiya led a delegation to Indonesia on the ministerial meeting on capacity for Palestine. Now, that post came very, very handy because we were able to discuss with Hamas the priority for capacity building, having talked with the Palestinian government authority in Ramallah itself. And some of us drove to Syria and Jordan to engage them, to hear from the both sides of the divide. It's a very, very delicate thing, but we do from time to time ensure that we service both the Hamas from Gaza and from Damascus. So that's as far as I can really say in terms of this. I don't think we are going to create a fully fledged mission in Gaza, because our understanding is that there is one Palestinian Authority, and its headquarters is in Ramallah. But of course, we cannot ignore the fact that there are tensions between the two within the PLO itself, and therefore the need to keep contact with the Hamas. Thanks, DJ.
DJ, thank you. I want to say to the DDG, it is interesting when you read the report of the delegation on that particular aspect. We have been interested in the business unit because it's not only Israel that has complained with the support base that they get from the desk. We went to Syria, we got the same complaint. In Ramallah, they have the same complaint. Surely, unless there's a coordination between the heads of mission to speak bad about the support they get from the desk, maybe that could be something else. But I want to believe that they indeed have a problem. I know that there's sometimes what is called a good man syndrome. That we have a good man in the head office, he's a nice gentleman, he's a nice woman, a nice lady working there. However, good lady, good gentleman, if he does not service those who are in the field, I would prefer to have a bad gentleman in the office but provide service in the field. It's not, where I'm sitting, I will not be prepared to accept that they get the service. In fact, they use the term, was it front soldiers without a red base? What was the concept? Okay. You will raise it with your DDG. But I'm saying, it can't be that. I think there's a problem in the desk. I think there's a problem in the desk, and I think at some point we need to take a view that might not be comfortable and really look at it and say, are we really going through with the good man gentleman's syndrome, or are we really taking the decisions that we need to take? I just want to put the perspective that Sbanda was putting forward of the statement, but I want to say that you read our report, because we have captured those things in that report. We're quite uncomfortable, to say the least. And that's why I wanted to keep verbatim what was said to us as much as possible, so that we can capture that particular communication and probably learn from it to see how in future we manage some of those things. DG, I just want us to proceed on with the presentation. We may not be able to, for the first time, deal with the annual report in one city by the look of things. But I want us also to come back and reflect on this Judge White report, because it affects all the old establishment, the integration issues, to come back and probably at some point look at it and say, how do we close this chapter once and for all? Because we can't continue to have this thing hanging. There were problems there, and we can't keep on carrying those problems forever. At some point, we need to take a decision, and if that decision makes people unhappy, probably we may have to settle with them and agree that it was said in one press conference that people do serve divorce papers. Maybe we should consider that some people. Let's start to page 24, DJ. Thank you very much. I will start on slide 24, and the chair director will go up to slide 24. But essentially, chair, all that we do in slide 24 is to indicate to you that basically we spent quite a lot of the money that you gave us.
and that the variance, as you see, is only 49 million out of that allocation. That's what happened. And on page 25, on slide 25, we further indicating that that 49 million that could not be spent basically was on two line items. One was on transfers and subsidies. And in the case of the transfers with respect to the African Union, it had to do with the fact that every time when we do our budget, we work on the base of some estimation of what the budget is going to be, of the AU is going to be, and then what South Africa's contribution is going to be. What tends to happen is that the member states, when they meet in January, they work that budget downwards. So we then have a slight amount that we have. And in the case of the capital assets, it's really project ongoing, but that moved just across the year, largely our capital budget. And slide 26, we just indicate that the total expenditure was 98.8%, and we indicate also some of those projects in Bujumbura, the South Africa House in London, and Lilongwe, which explain most of the under expenditure on the capital project. And those really, that money was rolled over. The next one is just to say, Chair, we will put something in the annual report. We've been reporting to you about our challenges on the ICT side and the fact that we are revamping the ICT backbone. Just to say that there is progress, and hopefully by the end of this financial year, we think actually we would have closed this. Now, on the head office building, the members fortunately were in a position to, some members of the committee, able to go to the site and look at the construction. Just two things to stress is that that is really going on largely on schedule, probably in total about a month behind schedule. We're expecting now that somewhere by the end of April, definitely we'll be in the new building. I think with the benefit of hindsight, the decision that was taken to enter into an early works agreement, looking at the spiral of building material and all sorts of things, was actually a wise one. Now, we have not done complete financial closure on the PPP agreement. We're not unduly worried about that, because that process now is stuck more with the Treasury. But what the Treasury has done, has allocated basically upfront about 800 million for that building. So all the work that has been done up to now has actually been funded from within the fiscal, and so which will limit the amount of money that is going to be borrowed and therefore limit our repayment. Chair, on the question of the management of the fixed assets, starting with properties, and just to say, Chair, this area and the area around procurement and the management basically of the asset registers and governments are a key area that we've tried to focus on over the past year. And honorable members would know that quite a lot of the qualifications in audit reports have related largely to this particular area. Now, in our case, we consolidated our property portfolio and created a high-level position of a chief director to really supervise our facilities management. And this was related to the decision that we took, and I think we enjoyed the support of the committee, that as much as possible, let's be aggressive in acquiring properties so that we can move away from the rentals. We indicate in the rest of some of the initiatives that we have taken now to try to proceed with that and acquire the properties, and also at the same time correct what was the problem in the past, which is to make sure once we've acquired those properties are maintained in good condition so that the government property or the state resources then are not laid to waste. So that process is going on smoothly, and I think another evidence of that is the fact that really we do not have an under-expenditure, a significant under-expenditure in our capital budget. The other thing that we spend a bit of time on that we expand on in slide 31 is really to make sure that we update our asset register. We have, of course, a problem compared to other departments, which is really that as we move to this accrual system and we have to keep an updated asset register, it means we must know the details of every small asset that we have in a very decentralized environment. But we're trying to work on that. And of course, we are working systematically through it. We've got a 3-year strategy that we've supported by the Treasury and supported by the Auditor General, which really prioritizes the high value items, whether it's paintings or buildings or those sorts of things. So that process is going on. Now, in slide 33 and 34, Chair, all that we really try to point out is that in the previous audit, there were certain things that became clear to us, either in the management letter or in the Auditor General's opinion, that were areas that they were calling upon the department to tighten on. The issue of debt management. This has to do not so much with debt of officials of foreign affairs. It has to do with the fact that we support delegations of other departments and provinces when they go abroad, and sometimes there would be major delays in reimbursing of foreign affairs. So a lot of work has been carried out by the department with that. We've entered into this memorandum of understanding, particularly with the big spending departments, those that have got officials outside. And I think that's reflecting in the improvement, and hence in the year under review's audit, this was not a major issue. I've already spoken about the performance information as an area that has been raised in previous audits that we are again spending a lot of time on, and again you will notice that this is not an issue that has even arisen under matters of emphasis in our audit report, which would be an indication of the progress that we've made in it. And with respect to the governance structure, this is really a question of tightening up our audit committee, identification of areas to focus on, and make sure that we work systematically through those. So Chair, really, that would be the part I would cover, which really covers the financial, the sort of issues that directly relate to the PFMA, and of course, as you yourself have already indicated, in fact, it's reflected far much more in, to place on record that as a consequence of all of that, that the department had an unqualified audit. Thank you.
Just add one slide, the 35 one, on the African Renaissance one. Just close it off.
Let me add that slide and also indicate something that came as a question that we struggled a bit to deal with. The question seemed to imply that there's a directive that came from the Department of Foreign Affairs for missions to have a 10% across the board reduction in their budget. Now, we did not have such a directive. What actually happened is that at the beginning of the year, when the Treasury was allocating money, they then, basically they did this with every department. They would say, this is what you've requested, show us how you are going to prioritize even before you ask for more. Then they would try to identify areas where in their own assessment they believe that there are savings that the department could effect. And having identified those, would build that as if actually those savings are going to be achieved as when they are doing the budget allocating. In the case of Department of Foreign Affairs, they put up front an amount of 23 million rands and said, you should effect a sum of 23 million rands. And these 23 million rands, you must get them by and large from your transport and from your entertainment. And basically what we then tried to do is then to look at the budgets of everybody, head office, mission, everybody, and look at that and say, how do we secure this 23 million? So that was the only thing that was done, but it was not a 10% cut in the budget of the mission. So that is just to clarify that. And then with respect to slide 35, Chair, just to say what slide 35 does is just to indicate now with respect to the African Renaissance Fund that the income that was put in the African Renaissance Fund during the year under review was 336 million. Now this is a combination of the allocation as well as the interest that accrues on the money in the account of the year. And that and the expenditure was 352 because that 352 also takes into consideration whatever amount was remaining within the African Renaissance Fund. And in the details of the annual report, we do give an indication of some of the priority projects that we funded. And again, just to say, even that particular report was an unqualified report, maybe it would be fair to just indicate to the committee that the only one thing that we are still working on, together with the Treasury on the African Renaissance Fund, relates to the Mali Africa Cup of Nations. And again, that's a classical example of the dilemma that we have as foreign affairs, where we are custodians of the African Renaissance Fund. Money is approved. Then the relevant department, in this particular case, which was the Department of Sport at the time, then runs into difficulties in terms of accounting for the money properly. There was an internal audit carried out. But to the extent that African Renaissance Fund is administered through us, then of course this reflects on the Department of Foreign Affairs. But that's an issue that we are trying to deal with the Minister, with the Department of Finance, and hopefully in the course of this year we can try to close it. Chair, that's what I would say.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would like maybe to pose very few questions. Number one question is about the concern about the budget which is allocated in some of the missions. I'll put an example. As we all know about the material condition, in particular in Ramallah and the like, the budget which is given there, I don't think that it's enough. If maybe the DG can clarify us that what criteria is being used to give some of these people the budget so that they can be able to discharge their work properly. And secondly, I'm a little concerned about the issue of opening of new missions or offices or satellite offices. I'll put an example. You see, we'll find that there are countries like in Western Sahara where already, as South African country, we have contributed a lot. Why we don't have even a single mission or office? And I assume that it's being coordinated somewhere, maybe in Algeria, whatever. But in the place where everything's taking place, we don't have any satellite. If maybe the DG can clarify us that how many satellite for office or how many countries who are still on the pipeline in that regard. Because my concern is one, a practical example, what happened in DRC, whereby we started to invest a lot of whatever, but at the end, they decided after we assisted them, after the elections, they diverted all of what they've got to other countries, except instead of giving us a priority as a country which was supporting them. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thanks for the information. I think we must compliment the department on the audit committee report. I think it's excellent and sets an example for other departments. There's one issue I just want to maybe ask on is the question of ICT. You've mentioned on page 10 that the voice over internet protocol system is 96% complete and the business process management is piloted. My question is, are you happy with your current business process management system? We've listened to the example of the desk at the head office not supplying the correct information to the mission in Ramallah, whatever. The question is, are you happy with the current status of ICT and business process management, or do you see maybe in the next 5 years a major review, benchmarking, maybe just to get indication from your side?
I heard the DG saying they are going to occupy the new building by April next year. Let's say hypothetically that these so-called counter-revolutionaries like terror win the elections. Will you be prepared to go there in that building? I'm joking. No, mine was just to joke. join the rest and commend you for the control of the funds, because you have received an unqualified report. Well done.
Where will it be?
The anarchist,
in the different day, or where you'll be. So, we don't know.
I take the cue from Ambassador Nen and Ambassador Maxil. I'll just watch where they are.
Honorable members, if you could switch off our phones. Apparently that's the reason why we have an interference. We thought that it's because we are not skilled, but it's clear that all our phones are on. So the system does not want to take it. You have all sophisticated phones. DJ, Mali. Mali, DJ. Is there a prospect in the near future, sometime in the near future, that will ever recover that money, or should we agree that it's unrecoverable and that we start budgeting and possibly discussing with Treasury how they assist in dealing with that situation? And the fact that you are waiting the Minister of Finance to approve certain things. What's the contingency in that regard? Should we not get the approval? Well, what do we do? Or are we so certain that we'll indeed get the approval? It's not a problem. And the assessment of the projects that we put money into. Do we have at some point to sit back and say, we've put an amount of 10 million in Uganda? Was it money well spent, or was it money not well spent? And I'm raising this because we are putting money into, for instance, in the observation of missions. Do we think that when Honorable Holomisa comes back from Zimbabwe, he says that he does not agree with anything that happened in Zimbabwe? We spend money to take him to Zimbabwe, and he comes back and says, I don't agree with anything. And the report of your head of the mission, the deputy minister in Angola, says everything was done. As a public, I need to see whether have we spent our money worthwhile. And I'm sitting with two views on that particular aspect. Do we do an assessment as to what we spend or what we put in our projects that we could sit back and say, yes, they have achieved their objective? How does this money improve our relationship with the countries that we donate to? Their contribution to that improving the relationship that we have with those countries. And that also is the second question, basically lumped on the assessment of whether the money is well spent.
Chair, thank you very much. On the set of questions around the assessment of the projects and whether we believe that this assists in improving the relationship, I'll defer to Mkhoelisi to just comment on that. But I really can't miss the opportunity now that
you've raised something, Chair, that that I really wish the portfolio committee could help us on. The truth of the matter is that we are discussing, and this is with respect to money, we are discussing with the Treasury, but I am not very hopeful that that the Treasury is going to finalize this process. And so we are really faced with a dilemma where money was spent, because even the audit does not make any suggestion about misappropriation of funds, but what it points out is that the records around some of the things, so they would establish that an activity took place in money. But the supporting documentation that explains all the expenditure is not there. So that is the problem, and I think that's where the Department of Sport is stuck. So if really we could secure the support of the committee to assist us on this issue, because we've done everything possible. And certainly from our side, as I've indicated, it was not so much an issue of negligence on our side. It's only that because we administer the African Donations Fund now, this sits as an albatross, basically on us. And we know that in the discussions with the Auditor General, the only other route that would help close this matter is if, on the basis of that audit that was done, is that at some point Parliament arrives at a decision where, in fact, they whether it's treated as an irregular expenditure or treated as what, but to bring some finality to that. Otherwise, it's going to be a never-ending issue that is in the... And, of course, as the years pass, the more difficult it becomes to do anything about it, because we are really talking about the Africa Cup of Nations of 1999. So it's a really, really difficult issue. So Chair, that's why I say I would not miss the opportunity, and probably we could try to push this with the Treasury and then come out exactly what it is that would be done. But our first sense is that this is something that would actually require Parliament formally, obviously through the committee, to look at this, and I think it would assist us. Now, I would really, if so, you could also talk about the issue of opening of new missions. But just to say on the ICT, we just had a management meeting where we reviewed in detail our general collective assessment of the progress on the ICT. I think the general sense we have is that where the system is working and where the new system is installed, systems have really improved, and so there's far much more efficiency. So we are hopeful that the direction that we've taken is right. There's still, because it's there's still some areas of frustration, largely because of the new system, and we do not have a strong, all the time available technical support to it, and we are trying to correct that. So, but for example, where we've begun to concentrate on, I think most of us in Pretoria have seen a significant improvement. The speed with which we can interact with missions, the flow of information. There are some areas which is around processes that we need to improve. For example, sometimes delay are caused because we ourselves jam the system too much with a lot of information that sometimes is put through a confidential channel when in fact it should be open source information. I mean, things like those, which is about the processes that we follow, we're trying to deal with that. And even before I ask again to comment on this, just to say to Honourable Swan, the issue around the budget is a very difficult one. You will recall, Honourable Members, that when we came here before our budget, we gave you a detailed presentation of what we requested and what we finally got. Now, quite clearly, a lot of our missions had a number of requests that they made that we could not meet. But what we have then tried to do is to build the budget upwards of saying, what are the statutory requirements? What are the things that we know that this mission has to do? And we made sure that all those activities are fully funded. Then we got into the stage where some of the things would have missions would have wanted to do, it would have improved the operations of the missions, it would have probably exploited possibilities, but we simply did not have the money. So that's the problem. So if I hear that, I'm sure Ramallah is not the only one. If I hear that there's one or two ambassadors or even 10 who are unhappy with the budget that's allocated to them, I can relate to that. But what we would be, we did check this after the first comment from the committee, and indeed we scrutinized the budget. There's only one mission that had a legitimate right, and it was not Ramallah, where an error was committed during the budget process, where in fact the allocation was such that it could not even meet some of the statutory requirements. Once you pay the salaries and buildings, you could not do other things. It could only meet the statutory requirements. But that was not Ramallah. In most of these other missions, and I'm stressing this, honorable members, because I'm sure as you go to the visit the different missions, you will hear some of these complaints. But part of it is genuinely related to the overall constraint. We have tried in the department to look at some of these areas, whether it's Africa, it's Asia, it's Middle East, to try and readjust and move budgets traditionally from Europe and America, which were the more established missions. That process we've done, but of course even that process, we had to meet a particular limit because beyond a particular point, then basic things cannot be done in those missions. So that process we've done, but again, as I indicated, we've got a review session that takes place around about this time every year. That's what I'm talking about when I said our corporate services managers are meeting in Durban now. And what we tend to do is that we look at all our missions, their expenditure patterns. The team has just already been to Madrid to look at all our European and American missions. And they will be going to Asia, to Thailand in the first week of November to look at Asia and Middle East. And during that exercise, we scrutinize every mission. And any mission that either is falling back on its program and is not going to spend money by the end of the financial year, or maybe there's been a readjustment, we take the money, agree with the mission, and allocate the money to any mission that might have more pressing issues that actually can discharge. So that, which is what has helped us to make sure that at the end of the year, we do not have any significant money that is unspent, and so that we keep on adjusting and looking at the priorities. But the general point about some pressures on some things that our ambassadors might have wished to do, but we simply do not have the money for that, I think this is the point I would really like to make. But maybe.
Well, thanks a lot, Director General. Thanks, Chairperson. I think with respect to the question of making an assessment of the impact of our assistance to countries on the continent, probably are pointing us to a direction that we really need to do this. I can just make a few observations on this question. Firstly, just to preface my observations by saying that it's difficult to make a qualitative and a quantitative assessment of foreign policy programs without having specific indices that you use in order to come to a conclusion as to the effectiveness and the impact of this program against the objectives or the intentions for which these programs were meant to impact on. But then, as you know, Chairperson, since the inception of the African Renaissance Fund, we've dispersed over 3.1 billion on the continent in a variety of programs aimed at promoting security and stability, and also aimed at building capacity. These are the broad thematic areas within which most of the projects that was implemented on the continent have been implemented, have been based. Now, if, for example, you look at some of the projects like the projects we are implementing in
Vietnamese. And it's a trilateral project. The, a group of Vietnamese rice experts are currently in Guinea-Conakry assisting with the implementation of that project. That project is already having a major impact in terms of food security in Guinea. It's having a major impact in terms of changing the lives of people in that country, which is a net exporter of rice and other basic foodstuffs because of the challenges they have around the skills of producing these basic foodstuffs. So there is a major positive impact of that specific project. There are other projects that I can mention which have recently been approved, which also have got a huge potential in terms of assisting specific countries with their capacities to manage particular strategic resources, like for example the projects with Lesotho on the construction of dams. These projects have got a major impact in terms of assisting Lesotho to manage this strategic and key resource. But also they've got an impact beyond Lesotho, given the fact that South Africa derives a substantial amount of its water resources from Lesotho. So these have got a major impact in terms of sustaining a number of aspects of life in South Africa, whether it's agriculture or human life and so on. So, as I say, Chairperson, I think maybe you're pointing us to a direction where we need to sit and look at since the inception of the African Renaissance Fund. We've dispersed, as I said, over $3.1 billion. Let us now do a qualitative and quantitative assessment to look at the impact of this program, whether it's the programs on promoting peace in the DRC, in Burundi, in the Sudan, in the Comoros, projects of building capacity in South Sudan, for example, where we've trained a huge number of civil servants in various skills to help them to so that they can contribute positively to the implementation of the comprehensive peace agreement that was signed between South Sudan and Khartoum. So these are the projects that we've implemented. I've just highlighted a few, but the list is, as you know, is quite long. So I think through you, DG, probably we'll have to do that more scientific assessment and study, and maybe at the next occasion we can present a report on this. Oh, sorry, DG, you also asked me to respond to the question on the opening of missions, particularly with respect to Western Sahara. I think it's something that we should consider. Just to say that where we stand now, following the decision of our cabinet that we should have a presence everywhere on the continent, we stand at 40. We'll be standing at 47 missions, certainly before the end of this financial year, with the opening of our mission in Monrovia in Liberia. And next year we'll propose that we open a mission in Freetown in Sierra Leone. We're still awaiting a decision on that, which would put us at 48 missions. And indeed, the target of opening everywhere else on the continent, including having some kind of presence in Tifariti or some way in Western Sahara, whether it's in Layoun or in Tifariti, is no longer a remote possibility. It's something that I think we're closely edging towards.
DG, I think what you may have also to do at some point, I think,
about the Mali situation, probably it will be that we should work on a specific, I would say, an explanatory memorandum that will give the background and all those things, and therefore get that explanatory memorandum to the committee, and then for us then to adopt it and take it to Parliament for Parliament to move on that particular, because we'll need to give background. We've been involved in it, we know what happened, but if you go to Parliament, you can't say, we know it, agree. We need to probably from your side develop that, and then once it comes, you can then assist and get Parliament to make a resolution, recommend a resolution to Parliament to try and close this particular matter, because it creates problems as a continuous thing. But the other thing, teaching course, is that, you know, this country deals with the policy of black economic empowerment. And if you look at the people that invest in the continent, are people that have resources, that have accumulated resources over a period of time. And your policy of BEE gets left behind, in fact, when they move to the continent. And some of them move out of the country precisely because they may not want to be bound by that policy. Will it be at any point that we should start thinking, DG, as foreign affairs with our sister department, that could be relevant, but start thinking of putting up an African Renaissance Fund that could assist those who may want to invest in those African countries but may not necessarily have the necessary capital to invest in the projects that could be viable, that could increase both your investment in that particular country, but it will also increase the security of food, whether the security of the democratic processes of institutions. Of course, there might be a criteria that we may use, which project and what project, but I'm saying maybe start thinking towards using this particular fund as a one leg. You may need another fund, I don't know. But I'm saying that just to think, how can we assist some South Africans that may want to venture into the continent on the basis that we may give them a grant or we may give them loans payable back to the country that we can then reinvest in that particular country and what will be the selecting criteria. So I'm saying that when we do that, if we can explore that possibility, I'm not sure which department will be relevant to do that. I'm just throwing it to yourselves. You can then refine it and say, no, it doesn't work, it does work, something like that.
On a point of order, I thought that one, we need to debate it first as a committee member without the department so that we can have a sort of a consensus on how to deal with that.
The Mali one? Or
No. Talk about the last one. The BEE one. We need, first of all, as committee members to agree on a modus operandi, how to approach whatever State Department. Because I might have a different opinion about that on your, what you are recommending. Others may also, but I think we need, first of all, as a committee, to deliberate extensively on that.
Fine, Honorable Lord, because the thought that was thrown to them without any attachment to it, that they must think about it and see whether it's something that is viable. I would have thought that even if they've considered that, they would have come back and say, yeah, we think there's merit in this thinking, or we just dumped it in the bin because we don't think that there's anything in it. But I take your point that we have to do that. That also includes the memorandum to deal with the Mali situation. Because I want to assume that no one will disagree that we need to resolve this matter, otherwise it sits there forever. DG, if you take page 37 to 50, it all deals with the with consular services almost, but it starts dealing with the consolidation of the African agenda. And once you reach 49, it ends with the consolidation of the African agenda. And then we'll then take 50 to the last point, because it deals with the South-South and global governance and issues like that.
Chair, thank you very much. really on consular, just to say that again, we had reported that we were trying to improve our consular management system, essentially to just enable us to respond with greater agility when there are problems. And this work started after the unfortunate events around the tsunami, where we felt that we actually have a lot of movement of South Africans, and there's no system of tracking that, and we only know when there's a crisis, and then to track them and assist becomes difficult. And hence we started this set of processes around the ROSA, for example, registration, which is a voluntary thing, but which is going to help us to track South Africans if they register and themselves online, so that as they move and as they change direction. Now we've completed the work on the ICT side that underpins this. We called all the relevant officials from our mission. People have been trained, so we are starting the implementation. Of course, in the consular services, we also wanted to highlight just two things which the department was involved in: unfortunate events around the Kenya Airways and the problem of Cameroon. But also, just to say, there's a growing problem of South Africans, of children born of South Africans who are in prison abroad, and this relates largely because we can see, especially on the side of drug peddling, we think increasingly the use of younger people, and so. But we work with social development with respect to that. Now, so on consular, I really think that we generally are making progress on protocol. Again, we just give an indication of the scope of what we've been involved in. A lot of visits that have to be facilitated. We are happy with the completion of the work that we've been doing on the two-state protocol lounges, and we are quite certain that actually they now project the sort of image we'd like, you know, our visitors to get as they arrive. We are now in the process. In fact, on Monday, a team from the department will be having discussions in Durban for the third protocol lounge that we want to establish, which is going to be linked to the Lamesi project. So that is what we're doing, which explains why we have not invested a lot of resources on the current airport in Durban. But we are going to create a protocol lounge in Lamesi. Just to also say that increasingly we're finding that we're drawn into supporting the 2010 team from the protocol side. Our team is integrated with the rest of what is going on there, and I think we are really prepared to play the role that we have to. But more importantly, one of the important things we are doing is to train the people that are going to be involved in all the host cities. So we are linked up with that particular process. You helped us, Chair, and would like to thank the committee and, of course, Parliament, and made the necessary amendments to our Act, the Diplomatic Immunities Act. Just to say, we've got a huge population, and the figures are there in slide 41 of the number of diplomats that we have. But really, I don't think there's any program we want to report to you now on that specific issue. With respect to the African agenda, just to say that now, in terms of the political line work, I'm conscious of the fact that you've called us at different times to brief and to engage us on specific issues. So what really we're just lifting up is just an indication of some of those areas. As you know, our work really revolves around the multilateral, and on the multilateral side, we are focusing on the issue of the harmonization of the regs, which actually I think is being taken today a step further with our President, President Mukande, being in Uganda, particularly for the creation of the discussion on the FTA that involves the three regions, which we think will help the issue of deal with some of the difficult issues around overlapping membership. We've been active in the issue around the Union Government. We hosted the ministerial retreat here. I think we've honored our commitments with respect to reporting appropriately. We're preparing another report now to the AU on how the country is meeting its commitment with respect to the gender declaration. there's an issue about the Pan-African Parliament. I think we've given the support that we need to give to the Pan-African Parliament. But I must draw the attention of the committee that there are certain issues that you've raised, have been raised at the level of the executive, that I think we need to just work on, not so much as foreign affairs, but the entire international relations cluster. Just to say that issues like, for example, the some negative sentiments among some of the parliamentarians about South Africa, the issues around that tend to be highlighted about crime, and things like those that might not be good things for them to be too central in the agenda, when in fact we are the host of the Pan-African Parliament. Honourable members, you know that the work that we're doing on the diaspora, we have reported on that, but just to say the summit could not take place, and I think all of us are familiar with the events and the timing of that and the recent events in the country. But just to stress that is not a cancellation of the meeting. By mutual consent and agreement with the AU, it's just a postponement, and we've started the process of engaging on dates. But we have proposed from the South African side that in anticipation of our elections next year, that it must be in the second half of the year. So that's basically the discussion we're having with the AU. With respect to NEPAD, what we focused on, first of all, is to close that discussion with the AU, which has taken place at the continental level about really the actual location of NEPAD. And I think the February summit of this year clarified that issue. The second issue that we've dealt with, I think we've tried to host a number of discussions involving the private sector and working together with the NEPAD Business Foundation to try and really profile concrete projects that are linked to NEPAD that business people can be attracted to. And I think especially the last one that we did, which fell obviously beyond the reporting year, but now in August, which was actually part of a significant build-up. We spent a lot of time during the reporting year negotiating with the AU about a host agreement with respect to NEPAD, but we've fortunately now completed that process. And of course, with respect to NEPAD, we've again been spending a lot of time making sure that it is at the center of all these other meetings that South Africa is participating in, whether it's on a north-south basis with respect to our engagement with the G8 or south-south meetings. The African Renaissance Fund, in slide 46, I think Chloe has already indicated a few of those projects. We just give a sense of the projects that we were involved in. But we thought an issue that required a bit a specific mention, even though it's part of that Africa integration process, is really the issue of the challenges that have faced us with respect to SADC integration and SACU. And just to say that in our thinking around the assumption of the chair of by South Africa, we came to the conclusion that the issue around integration and the issue around fostering greater political cohesion in the region must be central in our agenda during our chairship. And with respect to SACU, we've discussed before our own misgivings about what's happening in SACU, the issue about the EPAs, what impact they have had. And the decision was taken that South Africa should participate very aggressively in a meeting which was going to be a ministerial of the SACU trade and finance ministers, which was held in August, and indeed we did participate. And out of that has come some sort of a position that is not perfect, but however is allowing to remove a bit of the negative energy that this discussion around EFAS has generated even within our region. Now, of course, countries have made commitments, but also I think on the positive side has been pressure, I think, generated first from outside, but also internally that's gaining momentum within the EU, particularly the EU Council, that some of the positions taken by the EU with respect to the EPAs require of the EU to add to some degree of flexibility, because indeed some of the positions are anti-development and anti the program of regional integration. But on this one, Chair, I think there's still a lot of work to do in the region. I think certainly on the side of the department, there's a very clear strategy we're pursuing. We've briefed our ambassadors, we called our ambassadors in the region very clearly about what we are trying to do to strengthen relations on a bilateral level, but also probably to plan a bit better before we engage on the multilateral arena to make sure that we manage some of the differences that we have amongst ourselves as member states of SALCO and SADC. On the peace building side, I think, Chair, the only thing that would report is that apart from the work that we're doing in Burundi, we were drawn in increasingly into the situation in the East. We consequently ended up placing somebody in Goma on a more permanent basis to watch the events that were unfolding in the eastern part of the DRC. We've been worried about what was going on there, and of course I think the events of the last few days have probably removed any doubt that we might have heard that the process is really developing in a bit of a dangerous direction. So I think we will have to continue working on that, but all that we are really doing is to try to nudge both DRC, Rwanda, to just honor their commitments. We're also trying in the other multilateral fora to also make sure that space is created for those governments to work through their differences and try to minimize the always attendant danger of the impositions of external agendas on the situation there, largely because of DRC is a very rich country and everybody wants to have a handle on it, and therefore bringing about more confusion into how the situations can be solved. But really, Chair, those are the issues that we thought we would highlight with respect to that. But overall, I think we are satisfied with the progress that we're making with respect to the advancement of the African agenda. We think that there are some threats in the immediate neighborhood, sorting out the issue of Zimbabwe, working through the tensions created by the airport, and probably some of those things we can manage during the process of our chairship. Thank you very much.
Looks like everybody's content with that. Oh, I was Kasan and Matasa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. DG, again, this is simply a comment from myself with regard to this question of the African diaspora. I know that, as you say, you had planned a summit which has been postponed. But I was wondering really whether between now and that summit the department could not sponsor a workshop on this concept of the African diaspora. Because there are a legion of schools of thought about the African diaspora, and why do we need it really? Is it going to assist us in transformation or economic reform? Why do we need it? I'm saying so because if we go into a summit and we meet people who have been dealing with these issues for a number of years now, but we want to contextualize this for the South African circumstances. I'm appealing with DG because with regard to the African Renaissance also, some years ago when President Beki spoke about the African Renaissance, I remember I was still in the executive then. Very few really wanted to deal with that question of the African Renaissance. And that is why it could not take roots in South Africa. It hasn't at all. In fact, we can say thank you to the Department of Foreign Affairs for keeping that light going in Africa, for sustaining the idiom of the African Renaissance. Because that's the only department where you are going to find this issue of the African Renaissance really being sustained. Because here at home, there was also those who viewed it very differently. Some of us thought, well, the president was now invoking that dangerous factor of African nationalism or black nationalism. And therefore, that is why in South Africa it did create fear among various races. That is he talking about the rise of black nationalism? What is he talking about? So it didn't really take root. Now I'm saying likewise with the African diaspora, unless we come to understand it here, it will not definitely take root. It will be somehow what we deal with in summits and so on. So I was saying that can we, in between now and that period, look at a workshop where we can be empowered as to how can we use this how can we deal with this question of the African diaspora? Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, I will just touch on these things. Looks like a problem. One, through our interaction at parliaments on the continent, we have received numerous requests, almost inundated by requests that South Africa should help in policy formulation on economic matters on the continent. So I think that issue would lead to the question that the chairperson asked about African Renaissance Fund. The whole idea of helping towards development, is this matter looked at by the department? Two, DRC, I wonder if one, the DRC has doesn't really have an army. I wonder if that process of the integration really happened to our satisfaction. Because there are reports that when the army tried to intervene, the national army, in fact, they tend to lose a lot of equipment. If they went in 3,000, they were, let me leave the matter. But I think that there is a question mark about whether that integration process has happened successfully. The last matter is on the DRC. I wonder if there is a link. I read that now there is a review of all mining contracts. I think today the newspaper is saying 62. I wonder if there is a link between that and the tendency of now and again eruption of violence on the part of the DRC. The reason I raise DRC is because we have spent a lot of money. It seems to be a very strategic country to us. We have huge agreements, as you know. Last time the DDG or chief director related to this did admit on the difficulties of managing the binational agreement. That's why I touched on DRC.
Thank you, Titi. You probably, when you deal with that, there's an interesting thing that we were interested in your observation and your assessment as a department. You know, in the last SADC HESA summit, Botswana was represented by the Minister of Foreign Affairs. We were interested to get an assessment of that. One could argue that it's unusual, but I suspect that in this case, there's an element of being unusual and quite interesting. So that we can hear your assessment of that, because in some of us, we believe that Botswana is behaving in a particular interesting manner, and that continues to raise our own concerns in the manner that positions that they take in international forums, the way they present themselves in those international forums. In fact, I must say that in the ACP, it went to a point where they divided even the sub-region, when it has taken us so long to try and pull that sub-region together. In the last sitting, they actually went and divided the sub-region. So it is going to take us some time to try and pull back the sub-region again. So I'm saying it has been an interesting way that Botswana has been going, and we'll be interested to hear
your own assessment as to how you look at the difficulties and how what direction Botswana is taking as you continue to consolidate the African agenda as you go ahead to do that. The other issue, DG, that will be of interest, it relates to the fact that as you go on to deal with these issues of the African Renaissance, you find yourself in a situation where you are sitting with an absolute monarch that remains undemocratic. In fact, it's becoming worse and worse, very much autocratic. And it seems to be, I'm unsure as South Africa how we want to deal with that particular situation. On one hand, you get the body of opinion of formations in this country supporting democratic formations in that part of the world. And then you have the government with a different approach to that. And that leaves us not to be sure exactly how you deal with that part of the world. The last meeting that we were invited in on the briefing by the NGO coalition, it was banned on the morning of that day, that briefing. And it could have been quite an interesting briefing. I know that Sibanda is very particular about the Swaziland issue. But then I'm saying that we seem to be pursuing two approaches on that. And if then you look at the broader spectrum, these are the very same countries that have placed SACO into a crisis. These are the very same countries that placed SACO into a crisis. And even there, we seem to be taking the bulk of the responsibility as if it's us that have acted in a manner that compromised SACO's principles. But we are not. We are actually ourselves a recipient of the behavior that has been displayed by our neighbors. So I'm saying we seem to be taking responsibility for something that we shouldn't. And we are all out doing our utmost to save SACO, while in fact the net beneficiaries of SACO seems not to be giving a damn whether SACO survives or it does not survive. So it becomes our crisis when in fact we generate probably 90% and they consume 90%. We generate 90, they consume 90, but then it becomes our crisis. I think the way we deal with it, it creates quite a difficulty. And probably your comments on that and see how we then move and see how we deal with that in regional integration and possibly, because some of those issues you said, they'll probably be answered in the free trade discussions that are unfolding. But when we go to a free trade and SACO presents you with the basis of work, and that's the entity that gets destroyed, it raises serious question. DG, related to that is an issue that in your slide number 45, you deal with issues of the APRM and peer review mechanism. We would like you to comment further on it, that how far are we as a country to deal with the issues that were raised in the report and our response in terms of the program of action on that particular aspect, what happened to those issues, and how do we deal with the challenges that were raised. You know, when you dealt with the flare-up of what is referred to as xenophobia violence, everybody said that we were caught off guard, we were not prepared. But if you go to a PRM report, actually pick it up there, that in fact this matter was raised to be problematic. If you go to the report of the Committee of Foreign Affairs, I think in 2005, Mewa is not here, 2005, jointly with the Human Rights Commission, you pick up that we actually dealt with this thing. So when we were caught up this time, everybody said we were caught off guard, and I'm saying
it's something that we knew it was growing up at some point, one way or the other. So I'm saying, how do we respond to the APRM? I know that we're not the lead department. DPSA was the lead department. But I'm saying that we have a particular aspect of us to play. And I know that we did raise the question of xenophobia, and I think in one meeting we commented that xenophobia is not only about Home Affairs issuing a document or not issuing a document. It has a bearing in the conduct of our foreign policy and the implementation of our foreign policy. When the flare-up happened, we had to go and explain ourselves to other countries, explain the situation to other countries. It was no more a Home Affairs problem. It became our problem. And therefore, that's why we want to say, well, how do we respond to some of these issues as a Department of Foreign Affairs? Thank you, DJ. I hope to Ross to come in before then.
Yes, I just want to add one dimension over this Botswana problem or challenge. Apparent no unreadiness now to comply with SADC resolutions in respect of Zimbabwe. Climbing on all the allusion that he made to xenophobic attacks and so on. Now, Botswana, no, because it's a small country with therefore a small economy. So for them to integrate a million people coming from another country, it immediately challenges, you know, the demographics of the country. So they can't talk of integration there. We may then talk of integrating 3 million people. So what I'm factoring in, aren't we experiencing some political fatigue by Botswana incurring this burden emanating from a tyrant who does not want to democratize and liberalize this country? Thank you.
Follow up.
Chairperson, Ubaba has triggered something, if I can recall well, in terms of our relationship with Botswana, the behavior of Botswana during the summit, because in particular around within SADC, I believe, and we were informed that they've marched out because of the presence of the president of Zimbabwe, which is Mugabe. If maybe the department can clarify us on that.
DG, what I want to propose, in fact, before you answer, that we take that set of answers, but we do not continue beyond page 50. It deals with South-South, and the next one deals with global governance. And it deals with bilateral relations, because we wanted to raise that when you deal with the South-South and global governance, you're going to deal with the IEA there. There's an outstanding work that has not been done, so we want you to factor in that work, because I think that we're party to contravening the resolution of Parliament, because we're supposed to insist on that report, so that it gives you the opportunity to fit in that report. How we are going to do it, given time, I don't know. We'll have to go back to the authority of Parliament to see how we complete this annual report. I don't know now how it's going to be handled. Parliament has so many squeeze days. The next sitting, Babus Kosana, is in November. We may have to get a special permission to convene the committee, because Parliament has taken a view that only the committees that have the current legislation must meet to finalize their legislative thing. So we might have to come back to yourself and say what the authority of Parliament says on this particular aspect. But I want us not to go beyond page 50 for now.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Ngozi Mxolisi to probably put some thoughts on this. But maybe just to say that, first of all, on the issue about the African diaspora, and then probably to have a workshop and discuss and make sure that we generate a bit of a common understanding. I think we would accept that. Let's take that as a proposal, Honorable Benskosana, and indeed we'll carry that. I must say, in a sense, we ourselves in the build-up, although we had a consultation last year, but I must say there was a sense that we had ourselves that maybe as we were moving towards the summit, that the necessary hype and activity in South Africa did not measure up to the significance of the summit that was oncoming. Now, part of the problem with that was that we moved slowly, largely because we were being host of a summit that essentially was not ours, so the pace at which we had to move on some of the things depended on that. But I think that would offer us an opportunity to rectify that, because indeed I think South Africa, there's need for us to engage in that sort of discussion, especially if we're going to play host to this. Then I'll ask Nkosi to deal with this, but I would also appeal, Chair, that some of the issues that we are raising are very difficult. Difficult in the sense that they carry with them enormous sensitivity if we are going to discuss very openly. And I am not sure if we would want, there are some of the issues that were raised that we can talk about now, and the policy might leave, but I have a sense that there are some of the issues, quite honestly, if we wanted to get into and talk openly, it would probably not be in an open meeting of the committee. I just have a sense of that. So that just might restrict the discussion. But having said that, I would probably request the policy maybe to give it a shot.
Thanks a lot, Director General. Through you, Chairperson, indeed, I think some of the questions that have been raised will probably require a closed kind of session between the department and the portfolio committee, so that we can explore the various dimensions and aspects of this issue. So I think the issue is correct. Just to say that on some of the questions, starting with the issue of xenophobia, the DSA response, I think we've responded quite adequately and comprehensively as a department. On this issue, you would recall that we went convened a meeting of all heads of diplomatic missions resident here in South Africa, where we briefed them about how this issue evolved, what we considered as the origins of the issue, its various manifestations, and its impact generally on society. So we've done that. We've taken that proactive step to respond. But also, we've informed our heads of missions all over the world about the steps and measures that our government is taking to deal with the issue. Quite certainly, the issue has had a major impact in terms of building particular perceptions of how people see South Africa. And I think, as you've correctly pointed out, it's not just foreign affairs that has got a responsibility to respond, but there are also other agents or structures of government that have got to mount a response, particularly the Departments of Home Affairs and others have got a major responsibility to mount a domestic response, which will then be the basis on which we will respond, will further amplify what we're doing internationally on this particular issue. I think on,
questions of Zimbabwe, the DG has indeed in elucidating our strategy as chair of SADC, he has highlighted the issue of the need to build cohesion, unity and cohesion of SADC. And I think this particular strategic objective of our chairship of SADC also arises out of some of the difficulties that we've had to handle with regards to Zimbabwe, which may have resulted in varying perspectives and views on how to move forward on this issue. And I think as chair of SADC, we've got a major responsibility to ensure that there's unity of purpose and mind within SADC on how to deal with the issue. We noted the difficulties with regards to the Troika meeting yesterday in Mbabane, but we're hopeful that further momentum will be put in order to ensure that we take the process forward so that there can be a resolution of the outstanding issues flowing from the power sharing deal that was signed last month. But indeed, I think some of the issues will require that we have an in-committee kind of meeting to engage in a much more in-depth discussion. On the question of the capacity of the SADRC, the Fourth Army, or the Armed Forces of the DRC, I think it's indeed a challenge. You know that the DRC is emerging from a conflict. It has never had a unified army, actually, since its independence. The DRC army has always been a very weak and divided army. And indeed, the conflagration and the conflict that took place in that country has not helped efforts to try and develop the unified and the strong army. So this is indeed a big challenge. And you know that there are a number of efforts. The Belgians trained part of the DRC army, and they produced a battalion. We did the same. The Angolans did the same. There didn't seem to be any coordination between all the countries that were keen to contribute to security sector reform in the DRC. But I think there are efforts now to try and collaborate amongst all these countries so that what we're doing is uniform and standard, and indeed does make a major contribution to the development of a strong army in the DRC that is able to defend the territorial integrity and sovereignty of that country. Indeed, the latest developments were General Nkunda's CNDP seized the regional headquarters of the Fourth Army of the DRC is a worrying development. More so that their seizure of that armed of that base in Ruagabo in the DRC, in the eastern part of the DRC, provided them with a much-needed, from their perspective, much-needed arsenal. They have now, as a result of that seizure, acquired surface-to-air missiles and other missiles, which would prove indeed very, very difficult for any enduring peace process in the eastern part of the DRC. So indeed, it's a development that is alarming, that we should all be concerned about. What is not helping the situation is the heightened tensions between Kinshasa and Kigali as a result of the latest developments, as well as the accusations, the counter-accusations flowing from both ends. I'm quite certain that you are aware that part of the agenda of the aborted meeting of the SADC Organ Troika was indeed also to deal with these developments in the DRC, not just the issue of Zimbabwe. I think the question of the reviewing of the mining contracts in the DRC
is something that we'll look at. I have not read the newspapers this morning, so we'll take note of that and try to get more information from our mission and see how, what impact this has on South Africa and South African businesses who may or may not have already signed contracts, mining contracts with the DRC. Chairperson, you are aware that President Kante will be leading the South African delegation to the Bi-National Commission. I think it's the sixth session of the South African DRC Bi-National Commission, which will take place next week in Kinshasa. And I think this will be also an occasion to discuss and get clarity from the Congolese authorities on the issue of these mining contracts and to see what impacts these may have on our investment. Quite certainly they will have a negative impact, but we'll have to see whether South African companies are affected by this review, and then we'll deal with other issues also, the routine issues that we normally handle within the framework of the Bi-National Commission.
The gentleman heard me. I was not worried about the impact on our investment. I was saying, asking whether perhaps there is a link between that review process and the violence and the insecurity. And that's what I'm trying to say.
DJ, I'm not sure you want to comment. I take note of the fact that you're saying that there might be issues that you may not want to be discussed in an open committee meeting. That may suggest that, in fact, when we engage the authority of Parliament on the second meeting, that we request them to agree that we close that meeting and we start from your comments on the region. And honestly reflect on the region and see how the region and the balance of forces within the region and the alignment and realignment of different governments in the region and what are the real difficulties that confront the region. That could possibly also help us to understand whether in Zimbabwe we are dealing with to use Babunduli's word, in Zimbabwe. Not in Botswana, in Zimbabwe. With the tyrant in Zimbabwe. Whether you are dealing with the tyrant in Zimbabwe or you are dealing with a difficult problem that might appear from an ordinary eye as being just an old man who does not want to change. But in fact, that goes to the heart of difficult problems that the region is facing. It's quite a fascinating debate, Zimbabwe, because we all move from different perspectives, and we all reduce sometimes the problem to purely that Tsvangirai was beaten yesterday, so we are all angry, and we all think that Zimbabwe is all about that, whilst in fact it's probably beyond just an issue of human rights, quite enforced. And there are other issues that impact on it that sometimes are not within our control, both as a neighbor and as a facilitator, and that there are other stakeholders that need to be involved in resolving the Zimbabwe impact. So we'll probably ask yourself to that when we prepare for that part, we do that assessment of the region and the players in the region. And possibly look at the source of power those players have, the influence, the source of influence those players have, and then be able to deal with what confronts the region. So that it helps us to understand the difficulties that why the current peace process is not holding in Zimbabwe. What are the challenges? Not from what we read on the newspapers, but also the real situation. On that part, I will have to make a commitment for all members that whatever will be discussed in that particular meeting, will not be, then members go out and discuss that in a newspaper article. I will engage different political parties of members who are sitting in the committee and probably the ANC also to make sure that whatever has been said should not then find its way in a print, because that will then impact on the status of what could be said and what cannot be said. It will tamper with the trust element that will come into being. So we'll have to take care when we deal with those things. I'm also sensitive to the fact that we might find ourselves, having said other things, find ourselves in a difficult. I could say them, DG. And that's what I said in Israel when the ambassador and the staff that were briefing us, they were saying to us that we need to be very careful of what we say and what not to say, because the situation is highly sensitive. And to the dismay of the delegation, I think they took me to task. They said, we will not make life easy for the ambassador. We are going to say what we want to say. And if there's anything said that is problematic, that's why he is a diplomat. We are politicians. We will speak as politicians. We will not seek to be diplomats. And therefore, we will then stay within our terrain. The day he becomes a politician himself, you'll understand that he's not a diplomat. So I'm saying that I could say anything. I could be critical as to why the Botswanaists were not here. I could say, what do I think, like Bakun Tulu say. I could use that word, a tyrant, but probably you cannot use it. I could use the word dictator, that you may not be able to use it. But I suspect that the license that I have as a politician will also be exercised with responsibility. It will not be a backless situation. But I'm drawing, indirectly, DG, I'm drawing your attention to what the DG Majira was saying about Israel. But in fact, we were indeed. I will not use the word that Mr. Banda used of negative statement, but we were indeed concerned that if that's how we speak as South Africans about political leadership in South Africa, it makes one feel cold in the spine. So we are quite concerned about the situation. And we hope that, and as I said, that we deliberately decided that we will keep it verbatim in our report. In fact, we went through the recordings and we made it a point that we are capturing it as it was said, so that no one should say, you edited this word, I did not mean this word. I'm looking at Mpo because Mpo was doing the writing and the final editing. When I went through the draft, I worked on it and I finalized and I said, this is what should go in, and we've agreed with them. So I'm saying it raises concern, DG. It raises concern. I'm aware that the term of the ambassador is coming to an end, but I'm aware that there are staff that are remaining. I am aware that there are staff that will be, who have just joined the department, who holds the same view that the ambassador holds, and say transfer official who's starting his career now. And I'm saying to myself, when it's 4 years, when these views are held today. DG, thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you. We will await the new decisions from Parliament about the date. And just thank you very much to the members for a very enlightening engagement, as usual. Thank you very much. I must say we appreciate the support and the pressure sometimes you put, but the support that you put to the department, and hopefully that we also are discharging our limited parts to make sure that we can make our conduct of international relations truly reflective of where South Africans would want to be and how they would want to be seen. But thank you very much. And we've listened to the criticism
And as I say, we might not be responding to all the issues, but I just rest assured we're taking them to heart to try and follow as best we can whatever needs to be corrected.
Honorable members, I'm told by the NEO that Friday we are meeting the delegation of Western Sahara at 9, same place. That's where we're meeting the Western Sahara delegation. Thank you.
Oh, that's on there. I live with it.